Welcome to our monthly Q&A with Kim and Jim. This month, they tackle transgender brain differences, the impact of racism on the brain, unethical applications of research, and whether brain science excuses criminal behavior, and more. If you have a question you'd like answered in a future Q&A, you can send your question to mindingthebrainpodcast@gmail.com. We hope you enjoy the episode, and we look forward to reading your questions.
Isabella asked a very simple question, which probably doesn't have a simple answer, but what is the safest way to use cannabis, Kim?
Well, actually, it does have a simple answer, believe it or not. So basically, a sort of rule of thumb around substance use is the slower you can have it absorbed in the body, the safer it is, for the most part, just from a pure pharmacokinetic perspective. So pharmacokinetics is a branch of pharmacology that studies the interaction of the body with the drug. And what primarily determines how quickly a substance is absorbed and therefore how quickly it's distributed and reaches your target organ, which in this case is the brain. One of the big factors that determines this is how the method of administration. So put simply, that's why smoking cocaine or heroin or inhaling it or injecting it IV is a much riskier form of taking that substance than it would be to, say, ingest, just because when you eat something, it has to go to the stomach. You have like first pass kinetics. It has to go to the stomach first before it goes to the liver and then is distributed to the rest of the body. So it slows the absorption of that drug down. So the safest way to consume cannabis is edibles. Right. If we're looking at all other factors compared to smoking, even vaping, the safest way would be consuming, just because, again, you're slowing down the impact. You're also not inhaling something, which is impacts your lungs. So you're at risk for forms of cancer. So there you go. Simple answer.
OK, edibles.
So Ethan, next up is a question about myths. So Ethan's wondering, what is the most surprising myth about the brain that science has debunked?
Oh, so my favorite myth is that we only use 10% of our brain. And this is something that goes around a lot. It seems to be a zombie belief, which is like it's got no life, but it keeps walking. And we use all of our brains. And in fact, when we do these brain scans, you know, you look at these pictures on the news of like part of the brain, only part of the brain is lit up. The fact is that when you scan the brain, almost no matter what they're doing, the entire brain is active. Neurons just are generally firing at a resting rate all the time. And the only way we get those nice pictures is by doing something called a subtraction task. And this is, I think, very important for understanding these brain scans, because what you have to do is you have to have somebody do the task you're interested in, and they do a task you think is unrelated, you hope is unrelated, and then you literally subtract the pixel values to get what's different about those things. And this can cause problems, for example, like the basal ganglia, because the basal ganglia is so involved with everything that it never shows up in it after the subtraction, practically. So it's very important to know what the subtraction task is to be able to interpret those things. Anyway, the whole brain is active. The idea that we only use 10% is a little weird. One analogy I like to use is, well, what percentage of your house do you use? Well, at any given moment, you might be using 3 square feet. Because you're not that big, but you, of course, use the bathroom for something and it's for the others. The brain's like that, but, you know, everything's sort of getting used all the time. Now, why is this surprising to me? Well, one thing is that, like, although I know everything I just told you, I know very well, it seems contradictory to some other things we know about the brain, which I find this a mystery and very interesting. The brain also has a lot of redundancy. People can do surprisingly well when you remove
with half a brain.
Yeah, even with half a brain, you could take away a whole hemisphere, you know? And so, you know, what would happen if we were to remove like 1/10 of every neuron? We don't know. Or like every 10th neuron, like we don't know what would happen. The brain has enormous redundancy. And what's weird to me is that the brain is incredibly metabolically expensive. It uses a huge amount of energy. Our brains are so big, it kills women in childbirth in traditional societies. Why is there so much redundancy if it's so important to be so big and so energy intensive? So it makes me wonder, like, why weren't we outcompeted by ancestors who had less metabolic cost and just had a little less. Is redundancy that important? Like, it must have been, but to me, it doesn't completely, I don't feel like I completely understand it.
Do you know why, apparently one explanation for why there is the myth about the 10% of the brain being used at any one time?
Historically? No, I don't.
So there's some suggestion that it relates to a study that was done in the 18th century. There was a French neuroscientist who was studying feeding behavior in chickens. Okay. And what he did was remove most of the cerebrum, so most of the front part of the brain, right? So
yeah.
The encephalon, the diencephalon. And what was left was really the very hind back part of the brain. And the chickens still hunted and pecked for food. And we're still able to swallow and move around. And so from that experiment, which was a bit medieval for sure, and wouldn't pass ethics to this day, the conclusion was, well, you don't really need most of your brain. So that's apparently one reason why that myth.
Interesting. Okay. Thank you. So let's get to a question from Sophia. Can certain foods or supplements really help your brain function, or is that mostly hype?
Right. Great question. And I think that this one is a very difficult one to answer just because research on nutrition and feeding is so complicated because you have to control for lots of different things. And, you know, you have to have massive sample sizes to have anything conclusive. But I will address a couple things. So first of all, we do know that consumption of what are called omega fatty acids are really important for good brain health. So why is that? So let's think about our ancestors from several millennia ago that, you know, Jim was just talking about our big, beautiful brains. Part of the reason why we have these big, amazing, very powerful brains, but also metabolically costly brains is that when our long ago distant ancestors started to migrate geographically across the earth, a population of them migrated to the seashore. And when they were at the seashore, they were able to increase their consumption of fish, and particularly fish with a very fatty skin, right? If you ever had a piece of salmon, you have that lovely silver skin on the back. I would encourage you to eat that if you can, because that is a very rich, pure source of omega fatty acids. So these ancestors would consume more of these very fatty fish sources. And guess what that omega fatty acid did? It was able to be consumed, broken down, get up to the bloodstream, get up into our brain, and aid with the development of the brain. And in particular, it helped with the myelination of the brain. So you've heard about white matter and gray matter. Gray matter is essentially the neurons, the primary cells in the brain. And so it's the cell bodies and as well as the arteries and blood vessels that feed the neurons. And the white matter is literally the fatty substance that kind of wraps around one of the processes of the cell body, which is known as the axon. And so the axon is like a giant cable that helps communicate from one neuron to another neuron. It's like a little highway. And the myelination, that fatty substance, it requires a certain amount of omega fatty acids. So in short, the more omega fatty acids we eat and the more that we consumed, the more omega fatty acids that we eat, the better able that you have myelination of the human brain. And therefore it helps with all kinds of things like thought and memory and the speed of thinking in your brain. So another thing that we know is the importance of vitamin D. So vitamin D, we don't make that as humans. We have to get it from external sources, which is our primary source is sunlight. So the more surface area of your skin that's exposed in the summer, with SPF factor, of course, the better, because that's how vitamin D is absorbed. And we need vitamin D as an excellent source of, again, good brain health. I believe the recent statistics show that the average Canadian gets like, or 20% of Canadians get enough vitamin D for good brain health. Just because we live in a cold climate, we tend to be covered up most of the time. So that's why I think there's a lot of research to support that we should be maybe consuming 2,000 international units of vitamin D as a supplement to your diet. Because there are, of course, dietary sources as well. But outside of sunshine and some varied diet, it's really difficult to get adequate vitamin D. So I would argue for good vitamin D supplementation. And the last one that I want to talk about, and there's lots of others, but just in the interest of time, is magnesium. So there's increasing evidence now that consuming magnesium supplementation Again, you can get magnesium from lots of different sources in your diet, but we often fall short of that mark. Is related to lower anxiety and actually lower symptoms of ADHD. So there is something there that's happening. It's emerging research with regard to magnesium, but another one that is one to watch, because I think there'll be some interesting research showing that in the future. So moving away from food, back to our research areas, our topics, our fields. So Mason is wondering, are either of you concerned or worried about unethical applications of cognitive science or neuroscience research?
So I'll start. I'll say that I'm not particularly worried about it. And that's not to say that people might not, you know, I'm not saying that nobody's doing anything that is unethical, but it's, from my experience, so small that I actually don't worry about it. It's not something I'm concerned with. That is unless you consider artificial intelligence to be part of cognitive science, which I kind of do. And in particular, I do worry about artificial intelligence as getting a little too much control in our world without the proper ethical constraints. And I do talk about that in some detail in episode 69 of our podcast on AI and existential risk.
Yeah, I think the only thing that concerns me ethically is Neuralink. I don't know, like the stuff that's happening with implanting stuff in our brains.
I'd be more worried about it if I thought that we were on the verge of anything, but
fair.
Like implants have, to me, like, I don't know what you think, Kim, but like implants have so many non-neuroscience, non-cognitive science medical problems, like with infection and,
yeah.
And like that, and we're nowhere near solving those things, right?
Yeah.
And so, I don't feel like it's sort of imminent, you know. Okay, so Lucas asks, is there evidence that social inequities, such as poverty or racism, can cause lasting neurological damage?
So Lucas, yes. Yeah, I want to sort of qualify your question a little bit, because the neurological damage piece, I'm not sure about that phrasing. What I will say is that what you are articulating is the social determinants of health question. Are there things that we are things like poverty, socioeconomic status, class, race, gender, do these things impact our health? Yes. I want to make sure we're not like saying that it's causing permanent damage. It impacts your nervous system. It impacts your body, primarily because if we think about things like racism, for example, somebody who's subject to consistent, persistent experiences of racism, that's a stressor. And what that means is that your body is consistently reacting to that stressor, which we know from a lot of large body of literature and research and science that these would be considered, depending on the timing and the nature, like how potent it is, considered traumatic events, right? So it can be considered a form of early life trauma or persistent chronic stress, which anytime an organism is faced with these things, you will mount a stress response. And if it occurs at a time when the brain is still developing, you can set up the organism for later life psychiatric or other overall health challenges. So yes, there is good evidence that social inequities, poverty, racism does change the brain. But I also want to leave with a message of hope. Just because the brain has changed doesn't mean it can't change in another direction as well, towards something amazing, right? So it's not a life sentence by any stretch of the imagination. It is definitely a change to the organism, but with the right supports and care, somebody can live a very healthy, well life.
How does understanding the brain influence debates about gender identity? For example, are there male or female brains? And are the brains of transgender people different from the brains of cisgendered people?
So great question. This is from Mia. And we have done an episode on gender, if you want to go back to that one. And this is a fairly lengthy answer that I'm going to try to say quickly, is that we know that, first of all, biological sex is determined mostly by the presence of whether you have two X chromosomes or an X and a Y, which is male versus female, biological female, biological male. But we know that there's a lot of variation even with that. And the presence of the Y chromosome, if you're a biological male, does set into motion a whole bunch of processes that essentially defeminizes the brain and also masculinizes the brain. So the default sex is female. The default sex is female. Presence of that Y chromosome kind of removes the female parts of the brain and then masculinizes the brain. So biological sex, male versus female, yes, they have different brains. Now, it's an interesting thing about gender identity, because we know biological sex, that's quote unquote between your legs. Gender identity is quote unquote between your ears. So gender identity is our feeling of being masculine or feminine, feeling of being a man or a woman, versus biological sex, which again, I want to emphasize, it's not as simple as XXXY, male, female. So please want to qualify that. But there is some emerging evidence that people who gender identify outside of what their biological sex, so a trans man and a trans woman, for example, their brains are different. And for example, the region of the brain known as the bag nucleus of the stria terminalis, or the BNST, which is a small part of the brain in the middle of the brain that's involved in a few things, including the stress response, but also in sexual behavior. It differs in size typically between males and females. That's one of the biological sex differences. And studies have found that transgender women who are assigned male at birth, that size aligns more closely with that of cisgender women. So it is that one doesn't change too much. However, there's evidence that white matter infrastructure, so remember I was just talking about the white matter of the brain, those myelinated neurons, trans individuals often exhibit white matter patterns that are intermediate between those of typical cisgender males and females. So that suggests unique neural connectivity associated with gender identity, which is pretty cool. And then there's also been some functional changes. So when we put people in brain scanners, so things like fMRI, and we look at the pattern of activity of their brains, we've also seen that transgender adolescents display brain activation patterns that resemble more their identified gender rather than their sex assigned at birth. So in short, yes, gender looks quite different in the brain, which is pretty cool.
All right, our next question is from Amelia. Do neurodivergent conditions like ADHD or autism, do they need to be cured, or should they be accepted as natural variations of the human brain?
Great question. And we do have a whole episode on ADHD, episode 24 on ADHD. And I think that that question, you know, particularly around autism, there are a lot of folks from the autistic community that really feel strongly that neurodivergency is important, that we shouldn't be trying to fix autistic people to make them more like neurotypical people. So neurotypical would be somebody who doesn't have a diagnosis, for example, of ADHD or autism. And so arguably, I certainly have been working in allyship with the autistic community, and I would say, there are unique traits among autistic folks that are an absolute contribution to society, and then we need to look at that from a strengths-based perspective. On the flip side, if you're a parent of a child with autism who is nonverbal or is experiencing significant challenges associated with their autism, would you not want some support for your child, some kind of therapeutic intervention, either to increase communication skills or to decrease challenges in the school or in the home? And I think that that's why we really need to look at this from both angles and both perspectives, that sometimes there's not things that we should fix. For sure, we should celebrate some of the traits among neurodivergent folks. But at the same time, if anything is happening that's influencing psychological distress or functionality, then maybe there's a place there to support those individuals.
Yeah, if I can make an analogy, little children are smaller. So we often will have lower drinking fountains and small chairs. And this isn't trying to cure them. It is accepting it as natural human variation, but that doesn't mean that we don't make accommodations and we don't make things easier for them. Just, I mean, even within human variation, Sometimes you it's good to help people out and make it easier for them because of their differences that we, you know, and we can see it as celebrating differences to help parents who have a nonverbal child, for example.
Amazing. I love that. Equitable. So our last question is from Jackson, wondering, can a deeper understanding of the brain excuse criminal behavior or moral failings? I love this question. It's a very deep philosophical one.
It is a deep philosophical one, and it is related to the question of neuroscience debunking free will. So we return to the my brain made me do it argument, and we've seen court cases where people say, look, this person did this, but their brain has this difference, and everyone's like, oh wow, okay, I guess they had no choice in the matter. I guess, you know, they were born with it or whatever, and all these assumptions that we have when we see a brain scan. But again, you know, every decision we make does have some kind of a neural thing happening, making it happen. And so, you know, I think that, you know, as a scientific topic, moral failings and moral blame is not really a scientific issue. It's kind of a social values issue. Whether, you know, why do we want to blame somebody? We might want to blame them so that we can know how to deal with them in the future. If someone lies a lot, then maybe we would be more circumspect when they tell us something. Or someone, you can't count on someone, then maybe you don't entrust them with something. Likewise, you know, for good traits, if someone is reliably trustworthy or compassionate or something, then you should know that going in. So that's, you know, useful. But also, you know, a lot of times with crime, we're dealing with legal philosophical things, right? So rewards and punishments. So a lot of our legal system for crime is punishment, not reward based. Okay, the legal system doesn't tend to reward people for doing good. It tends to focus on punishing people for being bad. And, you know, their legal philosophy has different theories about why we might do that. You know, maybe it's they just deserve it. That's the retribution idea. The victims deserve to see that person punished or something like that. Another is rehabilitation. Sometimes we think that punishing people rehabilitates them and makes them act better. And, you know, I think that sometimes that can happen. People go to jail and they're like, no way, never again. And they and they don't. But sometimes it increases crime. And also putting people away in a prison or something keeps them, while they're in the prison, they aren't doing other things in society. So there's this, you know, keeping them so that they can't, like, physically can't commit the same crimes, although they do bad things in prison sometimes. And so to me, you know, whether we want to say that someone is morally responsible or not, I really would want to ask what's at stake here. Like, what is the context that we're talking about? Are we talking about what to do in a legal sense as a society? Are we talking about blame? Or are we, you know, talking about something more like neuroscience and cognitive science, where we might be like, okay, well, you know, when we say a moral failing, that is whether something's a moral failing or a moral quality is dependent on our moral theory. And, you know, there is significant overlap with moral theories, but also there are differences. And like in many traditional cultures, it is considered the right thing to do to lie or steal from people not in your family to help people in your family. In a lot of weird cultures, we think that that's unfair and you should treat strangers fairly. And just because someone's your family doesn't mean that you should give them, you should, you know, hurt other people to help them. So, you know, there are moral differences. And if someone does or does not give a cushy job to a family member, could be good or bad depending on different moral outlooks. And so it's not without a framework of morality, you can't look at the brain and say, aha, there's a moral failing. You might see why they do or don't help, you know, particularly help their family in that case. But the moral question is more of a values question that science can't handle by itself.
Sorry, I got distracted by Pistachio waking up and noticing him there.
Yeah, why don't we just introduce Pistachio just to close. Everybody, this is my dog Pistachio, who sometimes gets mentioned. So
the sweetest pupper ever. Hi, Pistachio. Like, he was sleeping the whole time.
Yeah.
And then he suddenly poked his head up.
Well, all right. You want to wrap it up, Kim?
That's a wrap.